Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. And today I'm going to have to ditch my British football vernacular and go full on gridiron, because our very special guest today is Dr. Mark Addix, joining us all the way from Houston, Texas. He is one very accomplished gentleman. And as I've gotten to know him, I've established that he's that perfect combination of wise and humble. Mark played high school football, again, the American kind, and then attended and played college football at Baylor University in Houston, where he was named an All-American, a term that means players who are broadly considered by media and other relevant commentators as the best positional players in a particular sport for a specific season. Mark was also inducted into the Baylor Sports Hall of Fame, so clearly very accomplished. He then made the step up to the professional game, starting with the Los Angeles Express, and was then drafted to the Kansas City Chiefs, and staying with the theme of Native Americans, he joined the Washington Redskins, where he was on the winning side in the Super Bowl, which is one heck of an achievement. He then switched careers, went to George Mason University and then Harvard University Medical School, and he completed his orthopedic training at the world-famous Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, followed by a sports medicine fellowship in Vail, Colorado. He has an active medical practice, has been chief of the Division of Sports Medicine and an associate professor at Baylor College of Medicine, has served as team doctor for the Houston Rockets, the U.S. ski team, rodeos even, and the University of St. Thomas. Mark is also a television sports personality with a focus on sports injuries. And he has five children, so being a short order cook for his family is probably his main hobby. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jonathan.
It's our pleasure. So let's start at the beginning. Literally, you were born in Stuttgart in Germany and your father was an army preacher. So you attended schools overseas. Many Americans don't have that global exposure. So how do you think it affected you and your upbringing?
Well, aside from being an army brat, a preacher's kid, and the middle child, all of which I'm sure scarred me. No, I think it makes a huge difference when you see people from other countries. I think you get this myopic view if all you do is spend all your time in the United States. And particularly, like a lot of Americans do, they don't even leave the city that they grew up in. So I think it was certainly very helpful to be born in Stuttgart and then go back to Germany and spend time going to high school, albeit an American high school, both in Berlin and in Munich, before coming back to the States.
Yeah, it astonished me once. I was fishing in Utah, in northern Utah, and there I got chatting to two fellas at the bar, and one had never left Utah, and one had never left the county that he was born in. It just it's astonishing to me.
So me as well.
So for the benefit of those listeners who are unfamiliar with American football, which would be surprising that there are any, but your position was offensive lineman. Does that mean that you ran up and down the field yelling abuse at people? What's the job of an offensive lineman?
The coaches are the ones that are supposed to run up and down the sideline yelling abuse at other people. But so our job is to protect the quarterback, right? So the quarterback is the glamorous position that gets the ball and throws the passes to the wide receivers and hands the ball off to the running backs, who then run through the line and score the touchdown. So we toil in anonymity and often only get recognized when we make a mistake.
Right, Ben, you clearly didn't make too many mistakes because you had a long and very illustrious career. So talk to us a little bit about your life as a professional footballer and the experience of winning the Super Bowl in 1992. I mean, that's an event that it's even shown over here.
Obviously a huge event. As a kid who grew up loving football, American football, obviously playing in the Super Bowl is your fantasy. So having that come to fruition was pretty amazing. And I mean, I loved the sport. I was a really big, husky, strong kid. You know, by the time I was 15 years old, I was 6'5", 270 pounds. So much bigger than my contemporaries, which makes you really good to be an offensive lineman. So from there, everything just sort of happened naturally. I got a scholarship to go play football at Baylor University, excelled there. And each step where most guys have a hard time, it just seemed natural to me. And so getting into the NFL, again, I was excelling and continuing to play well. So my entire career with the Kansas City Chiefs, I was a starting offensive lineman. And then when I got to the Redskins, I was more of a utility backup. So I was not on the starting offensive line, but when a guy was tired or injured, I'd go in. And so that's the team I was on with the Redskins for three seasons. And in my final season, we won a Super Bowl. And it was incredible. I mean, you know, obviously you get all kinds of gifts all throughout the season as your team is doing well. And then to win the Super Bowl was pretty magical.
But the life of a professional sportsman, and certainly over here with soccer, as it's known in the United States, they're seen as, you know, obviously elite athletes, very highly privileged. And people wonder how they spend their time. What's the day like for a professional footballer, contrasting it with the life of a surgeon? There's the same sort of disciplines, I presume.
Well, I mean, the one thing is I tell people everyone should have a job like a professional football player, where you get paid well, you're forced to work out and exercise, and there are nutritionists that are making sure you're eating well. And then on top of that, you get 6 months off a year. I think there'd be a lot of happy people in the world if everyone was paid well and got 6 months of vacation. That being said, a day-to-day life in season, the only day you had off was Tuesday, because we play our games on Sunday. We check in on Monday for treatment with the athletic trainers and to watch film. So Tuesday is your day off. And then Wednesday and Thursday are pretty intense practice days where you're doing some contact drills and it's fairly physical. Friday, they start to scale it back. You're practicing, but it's pretty light. There's no contact to try to start getting guys ready to play in the game. Saturday is just a walkthrough. You just basically show up and in sweats, you sort of walk through some stuff. Really, you don't spend more than an hour or so at the facility. Obviously, they're expecting you to go home and rest to be ready for the game on Sundays.
So you win the Super Bowl. That was what, 92?
Correct.
Yeah, so you win the Super Bowl. What came next? What were you thinking about doing?
You know, I think that anyone that I knew that played professional sports, as soon as they knew what they wanted to do next, they basically were out the door. I think you need to be of singular focus to stay in shape and to stay on top of your game in order to keep your job in professional sports. And so I had not given it any thought about what I wanted to do next until my career was over. And then, you know, you're thinking, what do I take my Super Bowl ring and go get a job selling something in the Washington, D.C. area? I mean, I really entertained everything from business to physical therapy to medicine, went and talked to all of the counselors at the different universities in the area to see, you know, sort of what they thought about my background. And in the end, I wanted to do something that I was helping people and also something that I could tie my two careers together, football and medicine. I thought they went very well together, particularly for a guy who studied sports medicine.
Okay, so before you're studying medicine, how do football and medicine go together?
Injuries.
Injuries. Yeah, well, we're going to come on and talk a little bit about them. So you decided to embark on a career studying medicine. And for those not familiar with the American educational system, you do a bachelor's degree first, and then you go to medical school. Over right. here, it's combined, usually, into one course of study, which is a tad longer. So how... what was your bachelor's degree? That was at George Mason, right?
Well, so my bachelor degree was at Baylor University, right? Okay. I had a business.
And you had your, when you were doing your football scholarship.
Correct. Yeah. So I literally had not one single course that would be accepted as a pre-med course. I had rocks for jocks and fun and physics. They were neither one on the pre-med list, right? So I also got some hours towards a master's in communications, also no help for medicine. So when I went to those counselors at George Mason, they said, look, it's going to take you, you know, 2.5 years to have the coursework necessary to excel on the MCAT. And then you'll still need some work to do. So I had to do 3 years of post-bac college work, take the MCAT, and then go to med school.
Just, again, just for the benefit of people listening, that's the sort of medical school application exam, right?
Correct. Yes, the MCAT is the medical school application entrance test. Yeah. So anyway, so that's what I did. I went back to school. Obviously, I did well. I did well on the medical school entrance exam. And lo and behold, I was not even going to apply to Harvard. I thought, there's no way I'm getting into Harvard. And my wife said, you know, you won't know if you don't try. And so my wife, Jackie's the one that actually encouraged me to do that. And miraculously, I got in.
Well, I'm sure it was a bit more than a miracle, and clearly she's obviously the smart one in the family.
For sure.
So you decided going into medicine that you already charted a course for yourself in sports medicine and orthopedics. Had that decision been made in your mind, or did it get firmed up in med school? And if so, what appealed to you about orthopedics?
I tried to go into it because my friends, when they said, what are you going to do next? And I said, I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. And they said, well, how long is that going to take? And I said, well, 3 years of post-bac college, 4 years of med school, 5 years of residency, 1 year of fellowship. I mean, they said 13 years. I mean, are you crazy? And so I went into it not saying I'm going to get a job in 13 years, but hey, this is going to be a great journey. And I tried to go into it with an open mind that yes, I was going in saying I wanted to tie my two careers together and do sports medicine, but I wanted to have an open mind that if I encountered something that really piqued my interest, that I would explore that as well.
So just again, to level set, how old were you at this time when you went into med school?
35.
So you're looking at coming out the other end at 48.
Well, okay, what am I saying? So no, med school, I think med school was 35. Yeah. But then I'd already finished the 3 years, right? So at that point I had 10 more. Yeah. So at 35, I was done at 45.
45. Okay. All right. So you then go off and do your orthopedic residency.
Yeah. I mean, it was truly unbelievable because I have no doctors in my family, and my college roommate went into medicine and he was a cardiothoracic surgeon, and I did go shadow him some, but it wasn't, it's amazing when you go to residency, my first day as a resident, I'm on call in the hospital and you feel a little bit like a fraud. You know, I mean, I'm just a med student, you know, I mean, I don't know that much. I know some things, but I don't know that much. And I remember being very, very nervous being on call and being called to the floor the first time to evaluate a patient on my first day as a resident. And thankfully, I have a little common sense. And so I went up to the nurse's station and I said, I'm Mark Annex, I'm the new resident. Can you introduce me to the head nurse? And they did. And so I said, look, this is my first day of residency. Obviously, I don't know very much. I wondered if you would come into this room with me and stand on the other side of the bed so that when I'm evaluating this wound, I'm going to look up at you and you can tell me if it really looks bad or if it looks okay. And that's what we did. And honestly, when I undressed this wound, I thought it was the worst thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I was ready to, you know, run screening from the room and asking for a real doctor. And I looked up at her. I looked up at her and she just kind of nodded like, yeah, that's okay. And so I reassure the patient, I redress the wound, and we leave the room. And I'm like, oh my gosh, thank you. I would have immediately called the senior resident and then of course berated by my superior resident. But thankfully I avoided that.
Yeah, very, very smart. When I started my residency, the professor of surgery, Sir Robert Shields, took myself and the other intern who would be working for him and said, do you know who the most important people in the hospital are? And I was a bit of a sycophant. So I said, you, sir, and the chief of medicine. And he shook his head and said, the switchboard operator, who can control who does and does not pay you and when. The person who operates the car park barrier, piss them off and you're parking a long way from the hospital. And the head nurse on each ward that you work on, you know, they're the most important people. So you were equally obviously very, very smart. So the rest of residency goes well, and then you go off to work under the tutelage of Richard Stedman in Colorado, who's a very famous contributor to the field of sports medicine. Tell us about your experience working there and the lessons you learned.
Richard Stedman, I mean, first of all, you know, when I met him, I wasn't expecting him to be this guy. He's about 6'4" and a big muscular guy, and he has this zen-like quality to him. And he just walks into the room and he's so calm, you know, and it's like, it's almost like he has x-rays and there are MRIs in his hands, you know, and he lays his hands on the patient's knee and almost instantly knew what was going on. I mean, to me, it almost looked like magic. But he was a wonderful mentor, an absolute perfectionist in the OR, you know, such a, both basic science and clinical, medicine researcher, you know, I mean, he really churned out a lot of research trying to, you know, better the field of sports medicine. I was in awe of him. I really was. I thought that no one could have a better mentor, both the way he treated and took care of his patients, but also how he tried to further the field of medicine.
Right. And You told me a very cool story about how you transitioned from jock to doc and then how you became a TV personality, the sports medicine guy. Please share that with the listeners.
Well, all right. So the kids went to Montessori school, which is kind of a hands-on experiential learning sort of school. And so we met this nice lady, Tricia Bradley, when we were at Montessori school with our kids. Her kids were there. And became friends, and we invited her to my graduation. So at my graduation, we had to try out to see who could speak at graduation. Typically, they had an invited speaker, but then they had two students. And one usually had a very poignant, serious story, and one was funny. And so I sort of put together a speech sort of making fun of myself about going from being a jock to a doc. And so I gave that speech, and afterwards she said, "Oh my gosh, I need to make you the sports medicine guy." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, my husband, you know, is the gear guy. I mean, he goes on Good Morning America and he writes for these different magazines." And she goes, you would be perfect to be the injury guy, the sports injury guy." And I'm like, "Okay, great." So I go off to residency and fellowship. And 6 years later, I mean, we stayed in touch, but not that closely. And 6 years later, she goes, "Okay, you graduated. Fly to Boston. We need to put a tape together." And so I did. And I put a tape together, and we did smaller things at first, but eventually put together our own show called Athlete 360. And then I got on ESPN doing injuries for ESPN. I did that for 5 years, and we're about to start season, or we will next fall, start season 8 of a fantasy football show on DirecTV's NFL Sunday Ticket. So that's a live show that goes 7 hours every Sunday while the NFL games are playing. And I do live injury analysis because it's obviously a big part of playing fantasy sports is if your player gets hurt, when's he coming back? And so that's kind of the journey.
Sure. And the injuries in American football are pretty intense. There's a friend of mine who, and I'm going to come on to that in a minute, who's an expert on head injuries, and he has a reel that he shows of hits in American football. And it's scary. I mean, a big guy like you, I mean, you're nearly twice my size. The thought of being, you know, when I played rugby and would play out on the wing, basically I was fast because I was trying to run away from people who were built like you, who were trying to kill me as far as I could see.
No, so, I am familiar with rugby, and it's a different sport, that's for sure.
Yeah, no protective clothing. Well,
no, I think you got to be a little bit braver to play rugby.
Yeah. So let's go back to orthopedics, and in your day-to-day practice, what are the operations? You know, I did general colorectal surgery. I love doing complex operations, but I got a real buzz from fixing an inguinal hernia and doing a nice, neat job and knowing that the patient would wake up and the problem had gone. It was done. And I found it a very satisfying operation to do. What are your favorite operations?
Well, it's interesting you bring that back. The operation in I think the operation that is the most commonly done in the United States is a partial meniscectomy. And so somebody squats down to get something out of a cupboard, twists their knee, tears their meniscus, which is the little bumper cartilage between your thigh bone and your shin bone, right? And so you're getting these sharp catching pains in your knee, and we can make two little incisions, less than a centimeter each, go in with a camera and a little instrument, trim out that piece of meniscus that was torn, that's getting caught, and instantly people are well. I mean, they literally can step on their knee after surgery and know, wow, I'm better. And they honestly feel normal within a couple of weeks. So it almost seems like a miracle. And yet it's the surgery that takes 10, 15 minutes to do. One of my most favorite. And then someone will dislocate their knee and you may have a five hour operation to reconstruct multiple ligaments. And that's a completely different deal. And you're going to need a year before you're going to see how well they recover. But I enjoy doing that as well. So, I mean, there is a broad spectrum and I operate on three joints, shoulders, hips, and knees, mostly with sports medicine, but I do some knee replacements as well.
Okay. So, I just mentioned traumatic brain injury. It's very much in the news, and American and the other kind of football are seen as a big issue. You know, we've had a number of high profile soccer players over here who've died prematurely or who have developed dementia or Parkinsonian type syndromes. And of course, it's been a big issue in America. What are your thoughts about where this is all going? What's it going to lead to? And is it going to lead to changes in the way sports are done? Actually, I'll tell you, the other day I was watching a soccer match on TV, and one of the players was wearing a head shield because he'd previously fractured his skull. And one of the commentators said, how long before we see everyone wearing one? So what are your thoughts about all of this, Mark?
I mean, American football, very, very difficult to completely eliminate the head-to-head contact that occurs. As a lineman, you know, on almost every play, there would be some contact between my helmet and the helmet of the opposing player that I was supposed to keep away from my quarterback. And on plays where we were running the football, where the quarterback would hand the ball to a running back, which is generally a fast, very shifty player, probably similar to you out on the wing in rugby.
By the way, I have to tell you that over here, shifty means someone who you don't trust and they're pretty good. Which is probably appropriate for some people.
Exactly. I mean, you can't catch them. You can't pin them down. Anyway, so but on those plays, you are coming, you know, you're firing off the line, and the first thing that happens is you make helmet to helmet contact with the player on defense who's trying to tackle your running back, and so, you know, they say that. Of the players that they've done brain biopsies on, it is my position that this CTE, this chronic traumatic encephalopathy, it seems to be fairly ubiquitous. Do I fear prematurely developing CTE? I began playing football at 9 years of age. I always was the hardest hitter on my team. Until I got to college, and then everybody was a hard hitter. And so I played football from the age of 9 till the age of 32 in a position where you're hitting someone on almost every single play. And so the chances of me having some sort of brain changes are probably pretty good, right? I mean, if we biopsy my brain later. Now, this is my take on it. I think that the players that we see who develop, you know, horrible syndromes of either dementia or or Parkinsonian symptoms, you know, it's like, I think it's somewhat like COVID, where you have people that get COVID who are in their 60s that have no symptoms, and then you get people who had developed horrible symptoms and pass away. And so I think that the brain injury thing is similar to that, because I do think that most NFL players will have changes to their brain, but I don't think that the majority of the players, or even, you know, a big percentage of the players, are going to have symptoms. I think that the players we've seen whose lives end prematurely, because we've had some athletes commit suicide, you know, I think that there's depression and there's divorce and there's, you know, substance abuse, and there are a lot of other things that played into it. Yes, they had changes of their brain, but I just think it's a much more complicated thing than some people try to make it out to be.
Do you think we'll see helmets, changes to helmet technology, and maybe the way kids play?
Well, they are changing the way kids, they are teaching football differently than when I played, when I grew up. I mean, they are not teaching kids to hit with their heads. They're teaching kids to play differently. And they do kick kids out of games if they hit helmet to helmet. I mean, they're doing a lot of things to try to change the way the game is played. And it's all for the good. And the helmets in football, in American football, have improved. I mean, they really have. They've gotten better on a regular basis. One of the best helmets they had, though, the company Visus, went out of business. And I was actually surprised, because the helmet was the best rated helmet of all the American football helmets. Do I think that that's what we call soccer, people may start wearing helmets? Yeah, I think that they probably will. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that hockey players didn't wear helmets, you know, and now every single hockey player wears a helmet. And I think that soccer players will start wearing a soft shell, kind of similar to what you'd see in water polo almost, or maybe, you know, some of the wrestling headgear. But I think we're going to see it.
Yeah. So staying with the role of technology, when my mum was alive, bless her, and she had terrible shoulder pain, and I took her to see a pain specialist over here, and he recommended all sorts of fascinating things, including a stem cell injection into her shoulder, because, you know, she had bone on bone arthritis, and some biomaterials being inserted into the joint. So what role are biomaterials and stem cells playing in orthopedics? What's the sort of, like, if you can give us the elevator speech version
I think that there are three broad categories. One is PRP, or platelet-rich plasma, where we can take blood from your arm and spin it in a centrifuge. And then you get some stem cells, but you get activated platelets and growth factors. And I think that we've seen good results. And I think there's good studies out that support its use, that it definitely has, it's biologically active and it's helping patients. And then there are these, different amniotic fluid, placental things that they're coming out with. And some of those are being sold as stem cells, but they really have more of the same active ingredients that PRP does. It has growth factors and stem cells. And again, not as much out there as far as research. So I tend to prefer PRP to some of these prepared products from the amniotic, fluid, amniotic membrane, and placental tissues. And then there's stem cells. And so I use stem cells. And if someone comes in and wants stem cells, what I do is I take 60 cc's of bone marrow from the pelvis, like you're doing a full-on bone marrow harvest. And then we put that in a centrifuge and you spin that down, and then you get mostly stem cells. Now, It depends on the age of the patient, how many you get. A young person, you're going to get far more stem cells than you are, for someone in their 60s or 70s. So it's going to be a more effective treatment in them. There are also people taking mesenchymal stem cells from peripheral fat and then growing them in a lab. But in the United States, that's not FDA approved. So to have that done, you have to leave the country in the U.S. Now, I just don't think we know how to activate these cells, right? I think that there is some benefit from both stem cells and PRP, but it's not like if you have a bone-on-bone shoulder, stem cells are going to have you grow cartilage. I think stem cells may decrease the inflammation and may make the joint a little bit happier, but it's not going to cure the underlying disease. And my hope is that someday we figure out what triggers need to be delivered at the same time the stem cells or PRP is delivered so that they do exactly what we want them to do, which is perhaps grow cartilage or repair torn ligaments or tendons. And we're not quite there yet.
So it's really about, it's just like most things in medicine, it's really important to have clear and articulate communication with the lay public, by our profession, telling people what is fact and what is fiction. And we, you know, you and I were talking about COVID and the whole nonsense about misinformation, because, you know, the lunatic fringe will fill in the missing blanks, right? So, So staying with the theme of my mum, bless her, when she was about to have her hip arthroplasty done, I immediately started to research which prosthesis would be the best for her. And I then learned that the most important factor for outcomes was not the type of hip, but it was the surgeon's experience. Do you agree with that?
Oh, without question. People ask me that all the time. Well, because I have a total knee. And so they said, what kind of total knee do you have? And I tell them, I mean, I had a Zimmer Biomet total knee, but all that mattered to me was that I picked my surgeon and then my surgeon does what he does every day. And what was funny is that I went back to the Mayo Clinic, had one of my mentors, Dr. Arlen Hansen, do my surgery. And, you know, he said to me, he goes, well, we have these bony ingrowth components and do you want me to use these bony ingrowth components? And I go, I want you to use what you want to use. I want you to do my knee just exactly how you're doing everybody else's. You know, I mean, I don't want to do anything special. I want you to make your decisions clinically based on how you'd make them any other day. And my knee's been fantastic and thrilled with it. But I don't think it matters if it's Johnson & Johnson or, you know, there's Smith & Nephew. I mean, there's a million different companies out there, Stryker, that make total joints. And what matters is that you have an experienced surgeon do it, and then you'll be in good shape.
And you actually make a great point, Mark, which is that doctors, you know, they say that it's good to be informed, but that, you know, and it's a huge privilege when one of your colleagues asks you to look after them. But we can often make really, really lousy patients. And your attitude is the best attitude. Just let them do their bloody job. And in fact, let's stay with that theme. I remember there was a movie with William Hurt called The Doctor, where he plays an emotionally disconnected cardiothoracic surgeon. I think he was a cardiothoracic surgeon. And he suddenly sees life through a different lens when he becomes ill with a malignancy. I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that you've been anything other than a very affable, warm and kind man. But having undergone procedures yourself, including your total knee, what insights did that give you, and did it impact how you deal with patients?
Well, I mean, I actually tell this to patients, and I used to tell this to my residents and my fellows and med students. What makes a good doctor is doing for your patients exactly what you would do for yourself or your loved ones. And you know, I guess it's a little bit of a takeoff on the golden rule, you know, treat others the way you want to be treated. But what makes a huge difference is having had some of these procedures. A young doctor who's never had any operations may think this is a great idea, but unless he's had a surgery, he doesn't really know what he's putting his patients through. And so I think that it's made a big difference in the way I practice medicine, having had double-digit surgeries and knowing what those surgeries were like and the post-operative pain and the rehab that it took to get back to normal. I don't lightly recommend surgery to my patients. And oftentimes I'm talking them into some more conservative therapy And some of those patients get well from the conservative therapy and some don't, and they come to surgery. But if they do come to surgery, they know that we've tried everything that we can to keep them out of the operating room and get them better in a more conservative fashion. So it's made a huge difference in how I practice medicine. And I do think that more doctors should at least have a minor procedure. I don't wish malignancy upon any of them, but at least having some procedure so they know what they're putting their patients through.
Yeah, there's an oft-repeated trope that we spend the first 5 years of our career learning how to operate, the next 5 years learning when, and the remainder learning when not. And it also calls into mind the old question, what's the difference between comedy and tragedy? Comedy is you get eaten by a lion. Tragedy is I've got a sliver in my finger, right? So that's really the case. So, Mark, you've gone through a fascinating journey to be where you are today. What are your thoughts about the educational process and how we select and train doctors? I can tell you in Britain, it used to be predicated, yes, obviously on your intellectual capacity, but there was an element of your personality as well. There were interviews, and today it's much more focused on, academic achievement. What do you think about all that?
Well, I mean, certainly to be a physician, you have to have a certain aptitude. I mean, because we are constantly taking exams to maintain our licensure and such. So, I mean, I think you'll be miserable if you're not very intelligent going into medicine, because you're going to find the process of becoming a doctor and remaining a doctor quite difficult. That being said, there are a huge number of different fields. I mean, there's pathology and there's radio. I mean, there are a lot of fields where you don't have to interact with others. But I think it's important that every med school class is filled with people that know how to communicate and that can have some empathy and some sympathy and take good care of people. And so to eliminate interviews is just crazy.
Yeah. You know, Sir William Osler, who was the first physician in chief at Johns Hopkins. And he said that a good physician should be able, that's obvious, available, also obvious. But the third was really the most important, affable. When you meet someone who's kind and nice, you put people at their ease. So I guess that takes me to my last question. And I love asking all my guests, if you wake up tomorrow morning and you are now the chief medical officer of the world, what three things would you do? And maybe, in this time of COVID, that will play some role. So what three things would you do, Mark?
I guess the first thing I would do is I would put together groups that of different specialties, right? So maybe you have these pods that are of 25, 30 orthopedic surgeons, and you place them so that people have access to them in whatever state, country that there is. And in each of those groups, I would put a biomedical engineer, a clinical research person, and a biomedical researcher. So you have the engineer that can help people design things that can further their field. You have the clinical research, so you can see what works, what doesn't work, and then you have the more basic science medical research, hopefully help us understand stem cells, and orthopedic stem cells and PRP and all those different things. So by having the groups together, I just think that people are going to have access to better trained doctors, and then by putting in the research people, I think you're going to further the field of medicine. And then the last thing is that I would want to incentivize each of those groups for either creating new ways to do things and creating, implants or processes or surgeries or anything that makes patient care better. And then the same with clinical research and the same with basic science research. I mean, so you can see there's a little bit of capitalist in me. I don't know. I think that sometimes it's really difficult. People ask me, and I'm in this big city of Houston, well, who's the best a rheumatologist, and I'll go, well, gosh, I used to use so-and-so, but now he's moved to Indianapolis. You know what I mean? I mean, it's and even though I've been in University of Texas and Medical Center at Baylor University, it's like there's such turnover that sometimes it's hard to find the subspecialists. And so anyway, I think that's what I do.
Well, I think we'd all be very happy if you did have that role. You're a delightful chap. I'm sad that we've got to wrap it up now. Mark, Dr. Mark Addicks, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and great stories with us. I'm looking forward to sitting down with you and watching your kind of football and having you explain it to me, because it remains a total mystery to me.
All right, it's a date, Jonathan. We'll do it. We'll do it and we'll get a good beer.
That sounds like a plan. So, folks, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. If so, please tell all your friends and like us on social media. And if you want to suggest a topic you want us to cover or to ask me any questions about interactions with our guests, you can email me at drjonathansakier@gmail.com. That's drjonathansakier, drjonathansakier@gmail.com. Otherwise, please join me next Friday for the next episode of the EMG Health Podcast. Until then, bye for now.